I don't propose to read them out because, unless you haven't read them. Yep. I mean, if there's a preference for me to read them, I will. But I'll. Very good. I also have a preference to. I would also prefer to not read them. At the start of the submissions, I have a summary of our legal and planning position. And I just note at paragraph 4, wanting to emphasise that this group of clients are not contesting the cultural evidence provided by Karunaka and the extent of the Wāhi Tupuna overlay and mapping. And we also don't dispute that mapping is it is an appropriate mechanism for recognising the relationship of Mana Whenua with the values of the Wāhi Tupuna. And really, the only thing I wanted to expand on in respect of that point is, and I think the panel's already picked up on this, is the finer details of the boundaries of each of the, well, not all of them, but some of the Wāhi Tupuna obviously could do with a bit more of a fine-tuning, and some of the updated descriptions in Schedule 39.6 and Ms. Pickard's summary. You know, there's now, I think it's, there's group 37 to 40 of those sites. There's reference to aligning with Crown land boundaries, and I'm just putting it out there as a one of the examples of things to double check that the boundary does actually line up with the Crown, the boundary between Crown land and other land. So that was just one point I wanted to pick up on in respect of point four, because that will affect at least, you know, four, I think, sites in particular in that schedule, four areas. I guess my point D about the adequacy of the Section 32 evaluation is a point that's a theme that runs through our submission, but also I guess you might have seen it evident in a lot of the other lay submitters. At the root of their concerns is sort of the part of the root of their concerns is the cost and delay and uncertainty of the consenting process. In my evaluation, the Section 32 evaluation did not even attempt to assess that, and it could have, and it, in my submission, it should have. And then another point I brought up yesterday was the integration, the best and the most efficient way to integrate these provisions in terms of the provision for the relationship of Mana Whenua with the values of the Wāhi Tupuna. So the recognition is primarily in the identification of the overlays, the provision for that relationship under Section 6E and how that's best integrated into the planning architecture is another a matter of interest that, you know, Mr. Devlin's got some suggestions in respect of, and they are similar to the suggestions of Mr. Farrell in terms of rather than having a standalone chapter that some people might overlook or not realise how it fits, even though there's signposts to it, there's ways to deal with that in the rural chapter in particular, in the existing rural framework that you've, and the subdivision chapter in the existing framework that you've got there. And I guess following on from what I touched on yesterday with Section 87BB and whether or not there's an option there that provides an efficient approval process that still properly provides for the relationship of Mana Whenua with the values of the Wāhi Tupuna. And just thinking about it some more, that the suggestion, if you somehow write into the plan that where the appropriate iwi entity, so whether it's at the Runaka level or at a Kaha level or a Tront level, depending on the development, where that entity has provided its APA, that APA is saying that the relationship between those people and those values has been deemed to be appropriate by the people, by the Mana Whenua. these provisions are designed to protect that relationship between those, the people and the resource or the history or the spiritual connection. So once you've got the sign off from the people, the actual scale of the physical works isn't the issue, because the effect that's, in my understanding, but I'm happy to discuss this and be convinced otherwise, the effect that's trying to be managed under Section 6E in particular is the relationship. So it's an anthropocentric effect. It's an effect on the people of the works. So if you've had the people say that they're happy, that the effects are acceptable to them, you've addressed that effect. You've got evidence that the effect on the people has been addressed. And so, with that evidence, you can then look at Section 87BB and say that, particularly in terms of subparagraph B, that the effects are no different in character, intensity or scale than they would have been in the absence of the activity, because the effect on the people has been approved of by the people. And you can say that's acceptable. So that's where my thinking went after a debrief with Mr. Farrell yesterday, and thinking about it further and just looking at the complete lack of guidance about how to apply Section 87BB and whether it can help us in this case both properly provide for the relationship of mana whenua with the wāhi tupuna, but also ensure that there is an efficient approval pathway embedded in the plan that people can use when appropriate. Those were the main points I wanted to emphasise, because I think you know what you want from me, and so I'd rather have the time used by you asking me questions, and then Mr. Devlin.
Thank you. So just to explore that a little bit, so what you're suggesting, if I understand correctly, is that the Karunanga are the affected party and that their sign-off would negate any further assessment under the wāhi tupuna rules. Is that correct?
That's the framework I'm looking at, yeah.
Is there a conflict in function between them being the assessing agent and them being the party that are responsible for an effective party approval in this context?
No more so than if it was a standard Section 104 assessment, I guess. So in Section 104 you apply for a resource consent and either of your own volition or because councils identified that certain parties will be limited notified, you go out and you get their effective party approval and boom, their effects cannot be taken into account. So conceptually, and as a matter of principle, at that higher level, it's the same. The Act already contemplates giving that ability to the affected party to be satisfied. And I guess the same, again, as at a higher level, matter of principle, not black and white, what the words say, but that boundary activities that you can, even though you might have a marginal breach of a boundary rule and technically require a resource consent, if you get the sign-off of your neighbour, you don't need a resource consent. So there's sort of two or three examples in the Act where it's built into the framework of the Act at a framework level.
I understand the effective party approval component of it, but I'm just trying to work it. I'm trying to think of another example where the assessing party in the procedural sense is also the affected party.
Yeah.
And I can't think of one offhand.
I don't see a concern with that, because that's an entirely appropriate status for mana whenua to have. It's a different status to other affected parties. They have different statutory recognition and so on and so forth.
And I suppose the other side of that is, do they have an exclusive say on mana whenua values to the point that an affected party approval would negate any further assessment of those values?
That's probably not a question I can answer. I think that's a question you could ask the kaitahu representatives. I mean, you know, and I think of others. You know, when you get the effective party approval of the Director General of Conservation for effects on public land managed for conservation purposes, that doesn't mean that every single user of that conservation land that you can't take into account effects on them. So, but that's at a statutory, they've got a statutory function they're signing off in terms of their statutory function, but it doesn't negate the fact that there might be a group of mountain bikers or mountain climbers who disagree with DOC having signed off on it, and they're entitled to have a say because they are affected.
Yeah,
so, yeah, but I think you're probably best to explore that with Okaha.
And I suppose anticipating that there may be situations where there are different parts of iwi who have conflicting values, so I'm just trying to work out if effective party approval can cover all of those values.
Mm.
From one party, but I'm sure we'll explore that further.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope so, at the same way as if consultation is directed towards the Runaka or Okaha or Trant or Te O Marama, whichever is appropriate, that once that's undertaken, that's the comprehensive assessment that's required. So at a matter of principle, you'd hope that if you've got similarly an APA from that organisation, that's the end of the comprehensive assessment of effects.
But yeah, equally, you just identified at least three organisations which we might have to consider. So, which one do you need effective party approval from all of them in order to negate further assessment under the 180 rule?
Again, I can't answer that question, but it's a very good question. Yeah. Not, my understanding is no.
I'm not saying it is.
Yeah.
I haven't looked.
We did look at the amendments and we didn't pick up that in our assessment. So I can't be 100% sure, but I'm 90% sure it wasn't amended last week. But that's something I can easily get back to you on. We can do that. In fact, maybe while I'm sitting here, Rasheen will do it. Yeah. It's awesome. Exactly.
We'll operate on an exception basis. Come back to me if it's an issue on the basis that my record, I'm stretching, I read the bill.
Mm. It changed a lot before the third reading. There were lots of SOPs.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So that's why I'm saying I'm 90% sure, because we trawled through all of that and we didn't pick that up, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there. Yes.
And more generally, like you've approached it on a basis that you think this might be able to fit, what do you think the purpose of 87BB is?
To remove the need for the cost and the time associated with getting resource consents when the actual effect of the activity is only marginally more than the effects that are triggering the need for the consent. So it's an efficient, my reading of it, my understanding of it when it came through 3 years ago, was that it was one of the simplify and streamline-y type changes to the Act of to simplify approval processes under the RMA. Yes.
If that meant you got all the affected parties' approval, why didn't you say that?
Presumably because they didn't think about it as an option. Or maybe it went too far for what they were intending to achieve. I have not read Hansard or the regulatory impact statements or anything like that, no. So yes, it is an assumption.
That says if you've got all the affected parties' approval, then you can ignore that effect. Are very specific to the situation in which they apply.
I agree.
And the question that's exercising my mind is whether, if in this instance, Kaitau gave you an approval, whether that, in the absence of a specific provision pointing at this section, that necessarily means that the effect is marginal or less. That's what's going in a slow circle in my mind, question.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if it was a Section 104 application, because it triggered the Wāhi Tupuna provisions, and council directed limited notification to the correct mana whenua entity or entities, and they provided affected party approval, I am assuming, you know, that then council would determine that the effects on mana whenua had been addressed and consent could be granted. Otherwise, what's the point of directing limited notification to an entity in the first place, if you're going to disregard an APA from that entity as addressing the effect that the whole rule framework's designed to manage?
Well, put another way, to go down the reasoning track that I've set out would be a hollow process for efficiency objective of this section if you put somebody through a consent process only to decide, well, the consent must be granted because there are no relevant effects because the relevant party has signed off on those effects.
Yeah, that's the issue I'm trying to fix. That's the solution I'm trying to find.
Yes,
the cost and the time of the consent process, the consent processing fees, the consultant fees, the time. It's they are costs that applicants will have to incur, even though the effect is ultimately addressed in quite a simple way and determined to be appropriate.
When you say that the purpose of 87BB is to deal with activities where the effects are no different in character or scale, and you said the effects are marginal, that's sort of conflating A and B.
Yes, I agree.
And I wonder, I mean, A and B are separate, and they have got and they do, in my planning mind, they address quite different things.
Mm.
The first, it doesn't say marginal effect anywhere.
No.
It says marginal non-compliance with requirements and conditions.
Yes, yes.
I would have thought that was the purpose.
Mm.
And then it says, and the effect must be no different in character, intensity, and scale than in the absence of the marginal non-compliance. So I would have thought the marginalness had to be to the non-compliance.
Mm.
And then you look at the effects,
and
then the council may decide that 87BB applies, but not, you know, to any old application where a written approval's been obtained, because that seems to be the purpose of the 104 tests.
Yeah.
Which you go through an application, it might be notified, you might get an easy consent, but at least that's the route, rather than saying, well, every consent that's got a written approval from the only parties that are affected should really be 87BB. Which is what you're sort of saying, isn't it?
Well, yes, I didn't extrapolate it out to that, but that is a good point.
So what do you think about the point about A and B being
separate? I agree, you're right. Marginal non-compliance, it's not marginal effect. And then B is about the effects, and also C is about the effects on a person, less than minor.
Would you read A mean a marginal compliance? Non-compliance means a marginal effect?
No, you're right. All three, A, B, and C, in terms of what leads up to D, which is council giving its written approval, A, B, and C are to be read together. And you're right, A is about what the rules in the plan say and how much the activity breaches those rules, and then B and C are about the scale of effects.
If it applies, it's a council discretion that would apply irrespective of what's in the plan.
Absolutely, I agree. You don't have to decide this, but if you did decide that it was helpful to provide some more, a greater measure of certainty and to reduce some of the angst that you'll be seeing from a lot of these landowners, the plan could provide some guidance about application of Section 87BB. In the Waitemuna context. So that's just in terms of people understanding where they stand and what they can do. That's just an area we saw an opportunity for the plan to be
that's not exactly what
more detailed.
Certainly not what Mr. Farrell asked for. I mean, he asked for a permitted activity status to be defined in the plan that sort of reflected 87BB, maybe even more generously than 87BB really says, because this doesn't say anything about written approval. Is that what Mrs. Evelyn's asking?
I think there's a spectrum of opportunities when we're looking at 87BB, and that's the position that Mr. Farrell and I were talking about yesterday is the furthest you could stretch 87BB, and we know that it hasn't been done before, and this is why we're exploring it. Moving back along that spectrum just to the guidance side of things, that's another area that you could be looking at to assist the council in getting its plan to be more certain and clear about when consent is required and when there's opportunities for it to not be required.
Approvals, you might need notification.
Mm.
Where do you stop?
I know, and what is marginal non-compliance? I mean, that term's not very helpful. So this is the thing, this is my point, that term's not very helpful, it doesn't provide certainty. This was the concern we had with the section when it came in. It's like, what does that mean? Who's, you know, one council's going to think one thing is marginal and one...
That couldn't add to that certainty.
Well, but that's our question. Could it, with some guidance? Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It can't fit the council's exercise of discretion, and it can't alter the circumstances in which the discretion is exercised. Like, as you say, it can't define what marginal is for this purpose.
It's tricky.
Commissioner Hill, since we've decided it's tricky, you've got me out.
I was going to say, I think the questions I had were exactly the same ones that we asked, and I was just really reflecting on that, you know, who is deciding what is marginal. You know, I was just reflecting on notification decisions, which are made all the time, what is less than minor, what's minor, all those things. So I think that's been answered. The other question I had, which again is a bit on a theme, and I think the way it's been cast in legal submissions is we have the section, and yet we're basically saying, but if the runner was on sign off on it, it's okay. But I go back to that, the previous section, raised 87BA, which is that boundary rule, which clearly says with the consent. So I think the Parliament have clearly thought about it in that context. If you get the native approval, it's signed off. This one doesn't. So I see this in a quite a different context. I was really going to invite you to make a comment on that previous section, which clearly envisages native approval and it's a tick. This one is not.
Yeah, I agree. They're consciously structured quite differently, drafted quite differently.
So have you seen this provision used?
No, and I can't find any commentary on it or guidance.
Because you can see what it's trying to do.
Yeah, BB or BAB.
BB,
yeah. No, I haven't seen it used.
Because presumably, just for my cover, presume it still requires, so it would, as they say, non-compliant, so it breaches something in the plan, so therefore consent is required. So presumably the consent is made and lodged, and then you work through the process and work it backwards to say what's not needed. Is that how you see that working?
Oh no, I think it looks like under subsection 1D, you don't need to have lodged the application. You could possibly have some pre-application discussions with council to get council to the point under D that it can, at its discretion, notify the person that they're permitted.
But presumably something would have to go forward to the council to trigger that.
I suspect so, yes. Yeah.
So the reality is most people would work up a resource consent application and presumably say, let's just say the 10 cubic metres was in place, we're going to do 10.05, but we need to apply, but we think we'll trigger this, so we'll put the application and maybe it's not fully worked up, and what then happens is the council and the council says, we might, well now you go and get the approval.
And Mr. Devlin, I don't know, may be able to, with his past experience at the council, have some insight into how a processing officer might address that.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Right. So having gone off on that tangent, but that's useful, can I take you back to the logic of your submissions? And you had made the same point. Recognise and provide all in section 16 doesn't extend to absolute protection. Oh. but both of which talk in different ways about avoiding significant adverse effects on waiting to burn.
Yeah.
RP is more focused on values, chapter 3 more focused on waiting to burn themselves. That's probably the product of when it was written. Like before the RPS was finalised. But they sound pretty directive and bottom line-ish to me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They're not. I agree. They're not. But they're not inconsistent with my position on my interpretation of Section 6E either. Avoiding significant adverse effects on the values that contribute to the wage burner being significant. You know, no, who could argue with that? That's not a no effect direction though. That's my point. It's not a no effect direction. It's not an avoid all effects direction. It's avoid significant effects on significant values.
Going to Section 32, you highlighted the lack of qualification of costs and benefits. And this comes back to the discussion that you'll be well familiar with in the Project Hayes High Court decision. Mm-hmm. You definitely don't have to have a cost benefit analysis of everything.
Yep.
And you don't have to qualify intangibles.
No. Agreed.
How should, what's the correct interpretation of Section 32 in that case? If you can only take a partial qualification, the Section 32, reread that section. It says quantify if practical costs and benefits.
Mm.
If it's not practical to quantify all costs and benefits, does that mean you should quantify what you can?
Yes, that's my point. I totally agree. Well, actually, there are some economists who do go through the exercise of quantifying intangible effects, but I'm not advocating that should have been done here. I don't. Well, my view on that's irrelevant. But it is possible to quantify the costs in terms of the consenting costs, that side of things, and having, if that had been done, you would have better information in front of you to help make a decision on the this plan framework.
Yeah.
And Section 32, it doesn't require a comparison of the costs and the benefits. It's not an economic equation, and whatever is highest wins. I'm not saying that. If it was just a matter of an economic equation, we wouldn't need any of us. We just put the numbers into the computer program and it would tell us what the answer is. But it's not like that. There's a lot of discretion and judgment that experts like yourselves have to bring to the decision-making process. But to inform that exercise of judgment, you need the best information in front of you and you don't have it because those costs that could have been quantified weren't.
I suppose the end of the concern that Ms. Scott put to us with counsel is the understandable concern that we have. You quantify the tangible and put it on the equation. If it sounds like a big number, it's going to skew the consideration of the intangible.
But it shouldn't, because you guys won't do that. You know that you've got to put a lot of weight on what Section 6E and Section 8 require counsel to do, and that's where that expert evaluation and weighting and judgment comes into it.
Wrong, and apply a strictly objective view. I'm grateful for that expression of confidence. It's justified. Going on to your issue and your discussion of integration, I wondered about 35 or 30 rules and standards regarding final farm building.
Mm.
Where farming occurs, either in a large level or a small level, like even a rural lifestyle lot has potential for a farm.
That's right, and there are rules in those zones too. Yes. No, you're right. I shouldn't have actually expanded that out to special zones like the Gibson Character Zone, Jack's Point. You know, even those zones provide for farm buildings or viticulture buildings or rural rares and rural lifestyle. That's right. So those exception zones and special zones that do have farming as one of the anticipated activities do provide explicitly for farm buildings. So that logic, as you say, my logic didn't go far enough there, and my logic should have extended to those zones also.
What do you want? Relevance of the NPS is a question of interpretation. I always thought the interpretation of legal documents was the lawyer, and as the lawyer's sphere, you're referring to Mr. Dewsland. So I think I'm entitled to ask you for your profession, your submission, not your opinion, your submission, and the basis for it.
About the relevance of the NPS UDC?
Yes.
My submission is supposed to my interpretation. Well, my submission is...
That Mr. Dillon's right.
That's right. The district plan's required to give effect to all relevant NPS and RPS, and on the basis that Mr. Devlin has identified some relevant provisions from the NPS UDC, the district plan has to ensure it gives effect to those and not frustrate them. So my submission is that it is a determination that has to be come to that these provisions will ensure that the district plan continues to give effect to the NPS UDC.
And I'm going to ask Mr. Devlin about this, but his reasoning might uncharitably be characterised as suggesting that because the way Tapuna provisions put a constraint on urban development, they don't implement the NPS UDC. And I'm thinking there are a vast range of district plan provisions that put greater or lesser constraints on urban development, you know, height limits and coverage limits. We'll hear submissions from submitters later in the hearing about design guidelines. There are pages and pages of provisions in this district plan that constrain urban development in small ways or large ways.
Mm.
What's the difference?
What's the difference? I've had a preview of the answer. The difference is particularly where subdivision and development are defined as threads, but particular way to Puna, compared to those other controls that you were talking about, which are, if you like, crimping of the urban development potential, there's a potential for an unknown potential for a complete prevention of urban development in areas that have already been, you know, that are within the UGB and already found to be required to give effect to the NPS UDC in terms of growth requirements and so on. So it's the potential blanket application of the provisions as opposed to crimping of the nature and scale of development, which the other standards are clearly designed to do.
Rather than getting the second hand, I'm going to talk to Mr. Devlin about that. notified the policies of Chapter 39 are inconsistent with the RPS. In what respect?
This is just that theme that they go further than it requires. It's as simple as that. We use the word inconsistent consciously because we're not saying it's contrary to the RPS. We're saying it's not closely aligned with it, would be another way to put it.
Does it give effect?
I think it does give effect to it. Plus, plus, plus. Yes.
Put another way. It gives effect to it and then does additional.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
To do all that, where it gives effect to it in a way that the RPS would not require.
That's good. Yep, I agree with that too. And I guess that's where I go back to my concerns about the Section 32 evaluation. Doing more than what's required, but without a proper understanding of the costs of that. If they're justified, are they not regulating something which is insufficiently regulated under the other legislation? That's right. Where there's not an overlap, they are.
It's not a complete overlap. Yeah.
Where the wahi tupuna is more extensive than the statutory acknowledgement area or the historic site and so on. That's correct. They are doing something that other legislation is not addressing.
And the requirement to give weight to Section 16 and 7A and Section 8 for that matter, how do you do that without consultation? How do you give proper weight to those provisions if you're not going to consult with another senator and find out what the issues are?
I agree. For projects of scale, an applicant, a sensible applicant, should consult with Mana Whenua so they can do a proper assessment of you know, and if the scale justifies it, commission a cultural impact assessment. So it's, whilst it's not a strict requirement procedurally to consult substantively to do an adequate AEE for projects of a certain scale, you can't do an adequate AEE if you don't. So There's no disagreement there. But that's, I think, one of the points Mr. Devlin makes, is those information requirements are already built into Schedule 4 in particular. So the danger of having a potentially unclear policy that might, you know, cause a council planner to tell an applicant they have to consult when in fact they don't need to because of the scale of the project. You know, that, it's the danger of the application of that policy, the consequences of the application of that policy as it's worded that we're sort of minded to, given that Schedule 4 already has those safeguards built into it in terms of information requirements. Yes, and I guess it's possibly not those policies where that direction is most clearly put.
Talk about Waihitupuna, and that's defined, and it's in my understanding it's a broader term.
Mm.
But this chapter 39 talks about it's to assist to achieve chapter 5, but then it says, but they're all identified Waihitupuna. And then, and we talked to Ms. Pickard about this, the first objective is a much broader concept, not applying just to Waihitupuna.
Mm.
So, in terms of understanding the plan, do you understand this chapter is only or should only be limited to those identified Waihitupuna?
Well, that would provide more certainty. At the moment it is ambiguous at the policy level in particular about whether or not those policies could apply to activities that trigger consent for other reasons and those policies are brought into it. So yes, I think certainty one way or another would be an improvement.
Because again, I don't know. Chapter 5 talks about the objective, which is, and Mr. Bevan has this in evidence, is that Waihitupuna and all their components are appropriately managed, and the policy is to identify them. So it sort of sets that it's a policy, but it's reasonable like a method. So if these provisions of Chapter 5 are clearly put in place before the identification. So I don't know from a legal it was to be read more broadly, but Chapter 39 is more specific, I think, to the, well, as I read it, to the identified provision, but he's just wanted some clarification. So your view is it needs to be.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. No, I'm fine. All my questions are answered. So we've got a 1 point,
yes.
One page summary.
Congratulations.
Good morning, panel.
Just hold it quite close, that's all.
Good morning. I consider it is appropriate that Waihitupuna areas should be mapped in the proposed district plan, given the regional policy statement requirement that important areas be identified. However, I consider the notified Chapter 39 objectives, policies and rules have not adequately taken into account the receiving environment over which wahi tupuna are applied and the implications of the identified threats and how these threats relate to existing zone provisions. While some urban areas have been recognised as being modified, I consider the recognition needs to be expanded to other zones that enable development and where development has already occurred. The Section 42A, Chapter 39 provisions require amendment to better integrate with the proposed district plan zone and earthworks chapters and to reflect the receiving environment. Further consideration is necessary of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity 2016 and the extremely broad range of threats that capture every activity and potentially act like a de facto open space zone. The Wahi Tupuna areas are hundreds or thousands of hectares in area and are landscape scale, yet the threshold for earthworks is just 10 cubic metres, which is very much at the site scale. The Section 42A version provisions will potentially trigger hundreds of resource consents per year, including for activities anticipated by the zoning. There has been no economic assessment of the cost of these applications. If the driver of the 10 cubic metre limit is protecting archaeological values, this is inappropriate as archaeological material is already protected under the Heritage New Zealand Puhere Taonga Act 2014, which already protects all pre-1900 archaeological material from damage or destruction unless an archaeological authority is obtained. The Section 42A provisions would also duplicate provisions from the Ngāi Claim Settlement Act 1998, whereby mana whenua must already be consulted in relation to any resource consent on or adjacent to or may affect land that is the subject of statutory acknowledgement as part of any activity that requires resource consent. The Wahi Tupuna chapter also duplicates existing provisions from Chapter 25, earthworks relating to archaeological sites and statutory acknowledgement areas, and zone provisions of the PDP in relation to the setback of buildings and earthworks from waterways, as well as farm buildings. The identified threats do not provide clear information in an effective and efficient way for both council and plan users. The threats for most Wahi Tupuna areas capture every single activity, so actually provide little guidance. I support some changes to the Section 42A version of the provisions, including the change to subdivision consent status from discretionary to restricted discretionary. I do not consider a specific policy as required for cultural impact assessments, as these are already provided for under the Fourth Schedule and Section 982 of the RMA. I also support some of the changes put forward by Mr. Bathgate for Kaurunaka. In Appendix 3 of my evidence, I've used the table of provisions used by Mr. Bathgate for Kaurunaka to summarise my position with regard to the various topics raised by the notified Chapter 39.
Thanks, Mr. Devlin. When you talk about threats, is it specifically subdivision and development that you're concerned about, or is it all of the threats?
I use that as an example of an extremely broad threat, but buildings and structures is in the same category. It's also very broad. So it's more than just subdivision and development.
So, just wondering if you could point out in your evidence whether it's the difference between a threat and an effect. If those are sort of being conflated a little bit.
Well, in my evidence, I suggested the term threat is quite loaded. It's quite a strong term. When I was talking to Ms. Kleinlanger Valslu from Okaha about this, she used the term trigger, which I thought was better because it's a trigger that the Runaka would like to look at that particular proposal. And so in my evidence, I've suggested the term trigger instead of threat.
And if it was referred to as a trigger, how would that resolve your issues around the NPS for urban development?
I think it would shift the focus from something subdivision and development immediately being a threat to being something that's considered. because in my evidence I say that you can celebrate cultural values through urban environments as well as, you know, leaving them in an undeveloped state.
You had, through your experience as a planner, you had a lot of experience with how Heritage New Zealand Pauhere Tauma Act works in practice.
A reasonable level of experience with that.
Because a lot of mana whenua would tell you that it doesn't protect sites at all, and that in fact, when unrecorded sites are discovered, it basically just acts as an authorisation to destroy or modify those. So I think when you're looking at sort of broad overlays or landscape scale, yeah, you have perhaps an opportunity to protect those more than you would otherwise if they were identified. You know, you can't actually identify those. Necessarily identify all those sites, or you may have areas where there are recorded archaeological sites, which generally, more often than not, means there are likely to be other ones nearby that may not have been discovered. So, how do you see that?
Yes, Mr. Bathgate mentioned in his evidence that, that it's those unrecorded sites that are probably the problematic ones, because sort of no one knows they're there. And what I said in response to that is it's probably correct. You know, the digger driver, you know, maybe hits something and looks the other way. Not sure exactly, but what I said in my evidence is that that's effectively a monitoring and enforcement matter, because the rule in the district plan is that they're protected whether they're recorded or not. But I accept that monitoring and enforcing that is a challenge for any local authority, because they can't be sitting next to the, you know, the digger driver on all the earthwork sites around the district looking for, you know, accidental discovery, unrecorded sites.
Just following up on that, if monitoring and enforcement is inadequate, could that in fact demonstrate that the rule is unenforceable, and therefore in section 32 in a sense you need to be looking for alternatives?
Good question. I mean, there's plenty of rules in the district plan that are sort of difficult to monitor and enforce, but that particular rule is, I think, treated as operative now, so it has come through the process. Certainly, any rule, you've got to be able to enforce it, so it's got to be something that's considered as part of the assessment. Yep.
If you were to separate out statutory acknowledgement areas and archaeological sites on the NZAA database, but that's not even available online anymore, unless you pay for it. How do you see that working? Would you, I think you refer to just the existing conditions map, wouldn't you? Would you keep the statutory acknowledgements mapped in Chapter 30 in the schedule, but have them a different colour, or
Yes, so support mapping the Wāhi Tūpuna, but for the ones that overlap with statutory acknowledgement areas, effectively carving them out of the rule provision, so because you've already got that statutory requirement that for any resource consent, it needs to be limited notified if you haven't got the effective party approval. So, I think I turn my mind to, you know, what does it all sort of boil down to with the statutory acknowledgement areas, and I think, you know, it all boils down to that you must consult if you're in those statutory acknowledgement areas. With the Wāhi Tūpuna, the difference is that it introduces some new rule thresholds compared to the district plan as it is today. So you might have extra consultation at lower thresholds, for example, you know, 10 cubic metres instead of 1,000 in the rural zone. But at the end of the day, the outcome is the same, as that consultation must occur with the resource consent. So yeah, I do support separately annotating on the maps those wāhi tūpuna that overlap with the statutory acknowledgement areas, and just letting the section of the RMA do its job there in terms of consultation.
Just for clarification, my understanding is that in those statutory acknowledgement areas, it's a full discretionary activity. Is that wrong?
I don't think it changes the activity status, but the application must be limited, notified, is my understanding, if you haven't got the affected party approval of the... limited notified.
Yeah. Earthworks within a statutory acknowledgement area in the proposed plan is a full discretionary.
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, yeah, the existing earthworks rule. Sorry, yep, you're right. Yep.
Is there a rule, is there a rationale that may not stand up in section 32 terms to have the wāhi tūpuna provision providing an RBA at a lower threshold, as you say, and the statute locking in the statutory or the provisions reflecting the Settlement Act coming in at a higher threshold with a full discretionary activity?
Yes, that is a consistency matter that needs to be addressed.
Well, on the face of it, there is a logic to doing that. It may not stand up in efficiency and cost-benefit terms, but I can think of, if I was trawled through this plan, there'd be hundreds of examples where at one threshold it's an RDA and at another threshold it's discretionary. So on the face of it, there is a logic because of
I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't think I can point out a flaw, but I think it's just partly a product of the staged approach to the district plan review, where the earthworks chapter proceeded ahead of the wāhi tūpuna chapter, and clearly statutory acknowledgement areas were thought of at that earthworks stage, and it was fully discretionary. And then for the wāhi tūpuna stage, it's been viewed through a different lens, and like you say, it's come out as different activity statuses, and perhaps that could be aligned.
Can I ask, when I look at the map of the statutory acknowledgement areas, and it's my understanding that they are predominantly water if they're not in the national park.
Correct, yes.
So presumably there's some definition of the boundary of those lake ones that defines how much of land is actually included. I mean, you can't see that from map 40 because of the scale, of course. But the wāhi tūpuna sites, as I see it, even the ones that are around the lakes, include a band around the edges of the lakes that is wider than the statutory acknowledgement.
We discussed that yesterday
with Mr. Randolph. Yeah, it is difficult to get a
notification, which goes to adjacent to the statutory acknowledgement area, but the actual statutory acknowledgement doesn't include the adjacent land.
It does actually. I was just going to say it is difficult to get a clear map of the boundaries of the statutory acknowledgement area. There was one in the operative district plan right at the front as well, which was probably less detailed than this. The thickness of the line on that one would have been probably 10 kilometres or something. Section 95. 95B3A says determine whether the proposed activity is on or adjacent to or may affect land that is the subject of a statutory acknowledgement. So it doesn't just have to be on the lake, it can be the lake edge.
Isn't that in the notification provisions?
Yes.
But that doesn't rule of the plan doesn't say and land adjoining, it just says the discretionary activity only applies in the statutory acknowledgement.
That's correct, yeah.
And but what I'm saying is that the RD status goes wider than that, so they're not, they're actually dealing with different things.
Yes, yes, I agree.
They're not a complete overlap.
So that means that the only thing that's going to apply in urban and urban area are the objectives and policies that require consideration of material values, and they will only apply where there's a discretion in some other part of the plan. So I'm left puzzled, what's the problem in NPS terms in considering material values?
So it's not the values, it's the threats, and the particular concern there is with regard to plan changes and rezoning. So one submitter, Sunshine Bay Limited, has been working on a proposed rezoning for 3 or 4 years now. It's directly adjacent to Sunshine Bay, and it is actually being considered by council at the Planning and Strategy Committee this month after many years of work. And it was with some surprise when the Wāhi Tūpuna chapter was notified that it was within a Wāhi Tūpuna, and of course there was a threat there of subdivision and development and buildings and structures. And so the NPS UDC is around development capacity, and one way that is provided is through plan changes and rezonings. And so you're right, by taking the rules away from those urban areas, it does address a major concern, but I'm also thinking around the plan change rezoning aspect for urban development capacity.
Well, I suppose, ask a rhetorical question, if someone wants to rezone currently rural land urban purposes, shouldn't
Mana
Federal values be part of that equation?
Yes, like I said, the concerns around the very broad threats, and I'm confident that you can also celebrate those cultural values through an urban environment, whether that's through place names, street names, ecological mitigation, restoration, that sort of thing.
Yes, but those sort of symbolic moves are not going to cut much ice at the issue. Of concern is clearance of lakeside vegetation, runoff into the lake, runoff into the streams, adversely affecting water quality. You can go some distance, but and while some of the Kaitaru values are metaphysical in nature, others are readily translatable into tangible environmental effects, but reviewed through a cultural prism.
Yes, I guess that one comment I'd make about the schedule 39.6 is that it doesn't list effects, it lists threats. And very happy to engage as we have done on this rezoning. However, it probably comes back to that term threat rather than trigger. And I guess in terms of that national policy statement, is it a provision that could affect, you know, the sorry, I can't quite recall the exact phrase of it now, but is it a when making a decision on the way or rate at which development capacity is provided, the policy there is one of the bullet points is limiting as much as possible adverse impacts on the competitive operation of the land and development markets. I guess two comments there. One is if it's about protecting water quality, that the regional council already has a rule in relation to that, which is footnoted on my page 10. I think the answer, I'm just finding my table of provisions which showed those different setbacks on page 33. I definitely think they can achieve the same outcome. Yep. I was particularly just keen to show to the panel that there are these provisions already in the district plan, and whether they can be utilised rather than potentially with additional assessment matters or matters of restricted discretion. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to show that there's actually already two sets of provisions for setbacks from waterways in the district plan. So.
Can I just say, have I picked up that correctly, that there are already two, one in the zone chapters, which cover, I don't know, buildings or something.
Yes.
And another in the
earthworks chapter. Yep. So I've set that out on page 33 in my table, and they are actually reasonably consistent between the proposed Wāhi Tūpuna setback and the existing zone setback. The earthworks rule is the same. It's always 10 metre setback if you're greater than 5 cubic metres. But there is that one zone where large lot residential where the Wāhi Tūpuna chapter proposes 7 metres, the earthworks chapter says 10 metres, and the zone rule says 20. So, I mean, I think there are lots of overlaps. My understanding is that, protecting Te Manawa Tawai is the priority, and, the rules around earthworks are designed to protect the water quality. So I think there are lots of overlaps there.
Yes, to protect the water quality from what? And in what sense?
and for whom. Yeah.
Sort of like saying, I've had this discussion with members of the judiciary about what is water quality. you get very profound very quickly. especially when that's in the group.
Just come back to the point I made in my evidence that I just felt the threats were so broadly defined as to capture everything, and so I think further work needs to be done to define those, but agree that it's probably the job's never finished yet. There can be new threats, and you know, for example, wild and conifers are, I noticed, listed in some which, you know, if 20, 30 years ago wouldn't have been listed as a threat probably, but are now. But yet, I guess just fundamentally my concern is that the threats are so broad as to capture everything, which doesn't really give a sense of what the true threats are. In my sense.
Well, I think that the professionals try and get you talking about things may be an issue, may be a problem, which comes back to your point that it's actually a trigger,
yes,
to require, yep, consideration, and it may on investigation be a problem, and it may on consideration not be a problem.
That's right, yes, I think the trigger terminology would be better there, yeah, because that term threat does automatically sort of suggest it's a bad thing.
I don't think... The impression I have is that we're talking about terminology, we're not talking about underlying objectives of what's trying to be achieved. Do you get that sense? Is this a ways and means discussion about how it might better be expressed as to what this is actually trying to achieve?
Yes, yep. Yeah, we support the mapping and putting those in the district plan, some objectives and policies around those, and happy to engage on activities in those Wahi Tupuna, but the way the schedule is written with those threats being so broad is that I think it's too strongly worded.
Assuming that we're too tidied up and that this policy more directly focused on significant adverse effects on non-ephemeral values must be avoided, would you have the same problem of inconsistency? You're not going as far as inconsistent, but not certain.
It was mainly the relationship to that first policy, 211, which seemed to be backed up with prohibited activity rules, but it said may, whereas this one, it was less specific in terms of the certain activities, and it was a must be avoided. So it was just that inconsistency between those two policies and the rule framework, really.
Is the difference, because some of those activities may not have significant adverse effects depending on their location, but if they do, they must be avoided. Is that a logical progression?
Do you have a suggestion on your table as to how that this issue raised by the chairman should be sorted out? You've got some suggested wording for policy 3213.
Yes.
Which amalgamates 214.
Yes, that's right.
And is it your evidence that your wording there deals with this, the problems you're raising with the chair's discussion with you?
Yes, that's right. So I didn't specifically list policy 39211 in that table.
No.
Yes, so sorry for my hesitation there. I was just refreshing myself on that. But yes, I think to answer the chair's question, that that would address the issue.
Any other questions? Thank you. Any discussion at 5:14 is given. I wonder about just restricting these to rural zones, because this comes back to discussion I have with Bucky Galloway, that at least in theory, the other rural zones, its character being most obviously plus rural lifestyle and even rural residential, are supposedly preserving a degree of rural character. If you're preserving rural character, it seems a short step to saying you should be considering mana whenua values as they provide a component of that rural character, landscape character.
Yes, in that paragraph it should really say applying the wahi te puna mapping and rules to just the rural zone is one option. So elsewhere in my evidence I have put rural residential, rural lifestyle and the special zones in with those urban environment chapters that Mr. Bathgate proposed for exemption. So the wahi tupuna would still be mapped over those zones, but just the rule framework, they'd be carved out from that as zones that anticipate urban development, because rural residential and rural lifestyle are residential zones, but you're right, they do also try and maintain you know, rural character to a degree.
Zones are supposed, well, they're not supposed to be urban zones, and if they are urban zones, then perhaps they shouldn't be have that zone.
I think I used the term residential zones. You know, rural res, you know, does anticipate residential development, one per 4,000, and I did put them in with those urban environment chapters because I felt they were not that dissimilar to, say, the large lot residential, which is in that category, but also because the district plan anticipates development in those zones, it set up that conundrum whereby to do the development anticipated by the district plan, you had to scrape a site to build a house, and that triggered the earthworks rule, which then led you to the schedule of values, and the threats were, you know, buildings and structures and subdivision and development. So by adding them into those exception zones, if you like, it removed that conundrum whereby the plan seemed to be saying two different things. Right, yeah, I'm probably using the exception zones term in a different way, which is that they're not subject to certain rules. They would still be mapped. Yes. Yeah, they're across from Glenorchy on the other side of the lake, and okay, down a bit.
South of
Kenlock? Yeah, yes.
Can I ask you the same question I asked Ms. Baker Galloway about what do you see as the extent of coverage of this chapter, particularly going looking back up at those strategic provisions, chapter 5, and I'll just put in your evidence the chapter 3 ones, which clearly talk about why
in my view, it is just dealing purely with wahi tupuna, and picking up on the point you asked, Ms. Pickard, I think that first objective where it says the values held by mana whenua in particular within identified wahi tupuna areas, I think that does raise the question of, you know, does it apply to other things as well? But my answer is I don't believe it's meant to. I mean, I think it's meant to just relate to wahi tupuna and other values probably captured by Chapter 5.
I think Ms. Pickard had a different view. That's right. So your view would be, if we agreed with you, that policy one would need to be limited to the identified wahi tupuna rather than a broader concept.
I think that's correct, yes.
And then what implication do you see that having for policy one and policy two? Because they're slightly different, but slightly stepped out. Because the first one talks about incompatible, maybe incompatible with a number of things, which, as you point out, lead down track some non-compliant and some prohibited. The next policy talks about other lists and range of other activities. In your view, would they need to be somehow combined, or?
I guess policies one and two, they both refer to the values held by mana whenua. Potentially that could be change to emphasise wahi tupuna values held by mana whenua if the objective has changed.
So the next question I've got, thank you for that. So the next question comes, just dropping down those policies and coming to three, and it does relate back to number two, recognise that certain activities, this is the avoid policy, and at 4.44 of your evidence in chief, you talk about must be avoided and leaves no room to move. And I'm wondering, how does that stack up against going back up to those strategic policies, which the cultural one, 333, says avoid significant adverse effects on wahi tupuna, avoid or remedy others, and then, if I'm jumping around your evidence, 4.31 then says that's almost identical to what's in the regional policy statement. Hasn't the avoid significant abuse already been determined through the RPS and through the strategic directions, and therefore, and I'll pick up this other idea of the values in a moment, this idea of avoid not having any room to move, hasn't that argument already been had at that strategic level?
Yes, although...
clearly with the RPS, but do you see there's an internal hierarchy with the strategic objectives down to the chapter?
The avoid is definitely in the RPS and that strategic directions chapter. The concern I had was that policy one, I thought those were the activities that were to be avoided just because some of them were given prohibited activity statuses. Like, whereas... 39.213, when it referred to certain activities that must be avoided, it was the relationship between 39.213 and 39.211 that I was concerned about.
So that partly comes back to the next question about certain activities, but before I go there, just following the King Salmon line of argument, you know, in the chapter 3, avoid significant, and in this chapter saying must be avoided, are they different or just the same? This is avoid, isn't it?
They're the same, I think.
So I understand what you're trying to say, that you need to grant specificity. The chair talked about, is it the values which are the critical component? And so the question I'd have asked you, if that was your answer to the chair, and this, the way that you redraft or your suggested redraft in your table, do you think when you go to Schedule 39.6, which sets out what the values are, and then somewhat supplemented, I thought quite more helpful by the description of those sites, in a planning sense, I don't know whether you still do resource consent applications, but do the value, the specified values, will that give you some comfort or professional ability to actually work out you're avoiding significant effects on those values, and the values are clearly expressed to do that?
Yeah, Yes, except that the threats don't seem to line up necessarily with the values.
So they might, right, okay. So, but come back to my specific question, is if, you know, if it's the values, significant effects on the values are to be avoided, I would go to that values column and look at those values, and it's those things that I would need to consider to be avoided. And I suppose the question I was asking, are they written in a way clear enough that we give you the ability to say, well, in fact, yes, there are some significant effects, but they're not values, they're not specified.
Yeah.
Or that they aren't specified, and therefore we need to avoid it in our application, well, might be framed in a different way.
I mean, I haven't concentrated on the values, but for me, they're not particularly descriptive. For example, you know, Mahika Kai, like I understand what that is, but
can I pose a question in a slightly different way there? Therefore, if it is the values which are to be avoided, should they be specified more clearly?
Yes.
There are, I mean, there will be cascades in terms of all of those. That's my question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I think my questions have mostly been asked.
You touched on a little bit about threats, and you actually just made the comment that the threats and the values don't necessarily align. I'm just interested in following that up a little bit, that in some cases there are rules that relate to activities that aren't covered by threats, and equally there are threats that are covering activities, threats that would cover activities that aren't covered by rules. What impact does the threats have on the assessment of the effects, and are they sort of obsolete, or?
Well, if I was preparing an application and it was in a Wāhi Tupuna area, I'd go to your the schedule and look at what the threats were in that area, and I guess if you're doing something that wasn't captured, then you could probably safely acknowledge that in the application and leave it there. If you were doing something that was a threat, you're going to have to assess that in your application, and the most easiest way to do that is to engage with the Runaka or the agencies that act for the Runaka and get some feedback on your proposal, really, and see if it's really a concern or not.
So let me follow that up a little bit further. So if you take a number of the areas, I suppose including areas 8 and 9 in the maps, Mawahu and Matapu, they don't identify buildings and structures as a threat, but obviously there's a range of rules that relate to buildings and structures. Are you suggesting that because they're not identified as a threat, there's no further concern about those activities? What I'm saying is the assessment only limited to those things that are identified as threats, or is it broader than that?
If it's in a Wāhi Tupuna, you'd have to assess it. But yeah, if you're doing something that's not a threat, I don't think you'd go beyond that because it's not a threat. So,
is a building on Wāhi Island a threat to Wāhi Tupuna value, to Mana Whenua values?
Not according to this, but there's a whole heap of other consent matters to be dealt with the building in that location.
So, with that in mind, is it necessary? You expressed concern before that the threats were too broad. Are they actually the opposite? Are they limiting the scope of assessing effects on values?
that they could be for certain wahi te puna. Yeah, it all comes down to the definition of those threats, and I guess the Rūnaka hasn't identified, you know, buildings and structures on those islands because I'm not sure why, but potentially are they in public ownership or something? I'm not sure.
Well, they are in that case, but I believe that was an example that.
I think it, you know, it can go both ways. I'm saying they're too broadly defined in many circumstances, but perhaps the Rūnaka will realise in 6 months or something, going, oh, we should have listed another one for
so
that.
The question, I suppose, is should we rely on the triggering of a rule and consultation with the Karūnaga to determine whether the activity is a threat, or should we identify the threats?
Well, I guess the provisions as per the section 42A, which still have the 10 cubic metre rule, would trigger the need for consent. And whilst it's not listed as a threat, you'd still probably talk to the groups.
Okay, thank you. Just touching on the topic we explored with Ms. Baker-Galloway before about affected parties, do you, in your experience as a planner, do you have concerns about an agent involved in assessing the values, then determining who are the affected parties also being responsible for supplying affected party approval? Is it self-determining that they determine when affected party approval is required?
In terms of having drafted the table of threats and things?
Well, in terms of making an assessment of as to whether there's an impact on mana whenua values.
It's an interesting question. You know, if you're doing something and you need your neighbour's affected party approval, you generally don't ask them to assess the effects on themselves. You know, normally the applicant has to do the effects assessment. But in this case, you know, the cultural values are held by a discrete group, I guess. And it is something I've grappled with a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, then just following on, you can assess the effects on your neighbour, but if their assessment is different to yours, you're not going to get the effective approval, so you're not in the same place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess the difference arises with the cultural impact assessment, which is it's more of a standalone document, if you like, that's prepared by a party who's been identified as being an affected party to an application.
Sorry, Commissioner, I interrupted.
That's right. I suppose in normally to determine if there was an effect on a given party, you would use an expert like a landscape expert to determine whether there's an amenity impact before determining whether affected party might be required from that person.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure if any other party could do the assessment of effects.
And I'll ask the same question I asked of Ms. Baker-Galloway. Is affected party approval from one or more organisations representative of all mana whenua values?
My understanding and practice with resource consents has always been to consult with Okaha and Te Ao Marama. My understanding is Ngāi Tahu have delegated it down to those iwi groups, so it's usually two agencies. Normally you require affected party approval from both. Certainly that was the case with a recent mooring consent I did on Lake Wakatipu in a statutory acknowledgement area. We had to consult with both agencies and both were able to provide affected party approval. Ngāi Tahu stayed out of it. They weren't interested.
If another party came out of the woodwork and said, I am iwi and I'm an affected party, would you also have to consider that person? Might be a loaded question.
I think you might need to ask the Runaki then.
I'm sure we will. But yeah, just interesting exploring that that question. The only other question I have is regarding, you've supplied map 40 identifying areas of cultural significance in the current, in the operative district plan, I believe, is that correct?
This is actually from the proposed district plan, but I was just saying to Ms. Baker Galloway that when you bring up the planning maps on the viewer now, because it's all online, you can't really get this, so I had to request it from Ms. Pickard, and it is available on the website, I think, but it was actually missing from the list, but I think it's been added in now. But I guess I was just emphasising that there is already a map of cultural significance in the proposed district plan.
So with regard to those sites that in the green that are identified as, excuse my pronunciation, Noahanga, is it the...
Noahanga.
And which I understand are sort of campsites of some sort. Are you aware of how those sites have been identified? And I suppose in asking that, I've got having particular regard to Lake Kawea, where I'm aware that the water level or the shoreline has changed significantly from its natural shoreline, and I just sort of wonder whether they are de facto sites of significance or sites of actual significance, or whether you've got any insight into how they were identified.
Yeah, I think they came out of the Settlement Act, they're campsites, so beyond that I can't really comment further.
Is it? But it may be the case that there's substitute sites rather than sites of actual values.
I think that's possible, yeah. They potentially were parcels of Crown land that were available for settlement, so yeah, I'm not sure if they necessarily hold cultural values, but the Runaka will be able to answer that.
Okay, I suppose what I'm asking is, do we rely on them to identify any specific mana whenua values in this context, or?
I wonder, Commissioner, whether you're asking the wrong person.
I was asking it, I suppose, in the planning context of, and it has been supplied in the evidence, but we'll ask the reading of that when they come up. Yeah, thank you. That's all from me, thank you.
Anything more from you all? Thank you very much, team. Appreciate that. We'll adjourn until 11 o'clock, take a coffee, and
I can confirm that the amendment to the bill, the amendment to the RMA did not change 87BB. Thank you, Ms. Giles.
Ms. Giles, for her down the back.